This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education, what's happening here with the people who know. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. And did I just hear Brian Medore say it's going to be really, really cold on Sunday? Of course it is. It's the weekend. It's going to be cold. Don't put your little seedlings out yet. Not yet. They always say you shouldn't be putting them out before Victoria Day anyway in Newfoundland and Labrador, and more likely after the first full moon in June. Yeah, Gary's saying the same thing in my ear at the same time. Well, to say 2021 is turning out to be an eventful year, politically speaking, would be an understatement. We're still navigating our way through the pandemic and the vaccines and the rollout of vaccines, and more people are getting them. That's very good to see and hear. A winter election was called that was delayed by community spread of a COVID variant, resulting in a move to a mail-in ballot system that left many asking questions about its legitimacy and the outdated Elections Act. The Green Report has painted a dire fiscal situation that most agree must be addressed, and we're awaiting the provincial budget. Well, here to dissect some of that and other matters besides is the interim leader of the official opposition, David Brazel. Hello.
Hello, Linda, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
Not a problem. Well, that's a lot. Where do we start?
There's a lot of things that have happened in the past year. There's a lot of things going to happen in the upcoming year that are going to be interesting for the people of this province. So, you know, I'm ready. Jump in there wherever you want to go, and we'll have a chat.
Well, let's go. First of all, I suppose the Premier has a State of the Province address tonight. What do you expect from that?
Well, you know, I would suspect realistically he's going to outline that there are some real, you know, fiscal challenges in Newfoundland and Labrador, and that everybody in Newfoundland and Labrador have to be ready to do their part to get us on stable ground. And I understand that, and I appreciate where he should be going with that. But I would hope he also paints that there is a positive picture in Newfoundland and Labrador. I mean, we have an abundance of natural resources and human resources that we can use to ensure that we move forward, and that there is a brighter future as we move Newfoundland and Labrador down the road, and that we collectively work together to find solutions to the situation we're in. I mean, keeping in mind, this didn't happen overnight, and it won't be solved overnight, but the best way you're going to find solutions is to engage the people of Newfoundland and Labrador. There's no better qualified group of individuals than the people of this province to solve the issues that they're facing. So I'm hoping he outlines the realistic situation we are, but be totally honest and open with people around where we are. Don't do fear-mongering, but at the same time, outline the fiscal situation, but at the same time, note we have the ability to not only, you know, right the ship here, but to put it on solid sailing ground so that at the end of the day, we have a better opportunity to move Newfoundland and Labrador forward to where it needs to be.
Do you think this is a little preparation for the upcoming budget?
I suspect he's testing the waters now to see what reaction will be based on the messaging he put out there. You know, unfortunately, I have yet to see it, nor has anybody else, or hear his message to know exactly what angle he's going on. But I suspect he's testing the waters to see what the reaction would be. Give some time to tweak a few things in the budget if necessary. I would think certain things in this budget will be the start or the template for really starting to look at long-term approaches to addressing our financial needs, but also, I would hope, and this is the most confusing thing, I haven't heard a lot about stimulating the economy. I've heard a lot about cuts and a lot about efficiencies, and they're all important, and they're something that we must take responsibility for and find ways to do. But I haven't heard a lot about stimulating the economy, ensuring that we have population growth in Newfoundland and Labrador so that we got a sustainable future. So I'm hoping somewhere along the way he notes that. I'm hoping this budget also notes certain things that can be done to not only generate our revenue, but make sure our economy is diversified enough and capable of taking a hit in one industry without it being too hard on the individuals in that particular sector.
Well, we've already seen, I mean, Newfoundland has a long history of putting a lot of eggs in one basket, if you will. How can we diversify the economy? What kind of opportunities are there? We know oil and gas, we know the tech sector is building, but should it all be the tech sector? What else is out there?
Well, no, I mean, there's a multitude of things here. I mean, we have about 7 or 8 very affluent sectors here, some we don't put much attention into. I mean, our fishing industry can and always has been, you know, a pillar of our financial stability. I think we need to find better ways to modernize it, to better have control over our own stocks, how we get better into secondary processing to be develop that industry. That's our traditional one. You know, I think we've sort of forgotten a little bit about our forest industry and the importance that that has. If anybody now looks at the price of lumber, that's just one small sector of that. But there's, you know, an important ability to do that. The aerospace industry. I had the privilege of talking to two main companies, and that being Aevis Air and PAL Aerospace, and the advancements that they're making, the work that they're doing for people all over the world, companies all over the world, is second to none. And we're talking, you know, anywhere up to 2,000 high-paying jobs, and that's just a start of what we can be doing there. The tech industry will flourish based on every other industry, because if you do something in agriculture, for example, or the fishing industry or aquaculture, or if you do something in the oil industry or the mining industry, very, very affluent, stable industries we have, the tech industry themselves will then start designing, and they then also will move forward and start being more viable. So, you know, we're in a good place. We just got to get all our ducks in line to ensure we support all of these industries so that the next move forward is that we've diversified enough that if we do take a small hit in one industry, if it sort of falters for a period of time, it doesn't have a detrimental effect on the rest of our economy.
My guest today on Target is the interim leader of the official opposition, David Brazel. We'll be back right after this.
This is On Target on VOCM. Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is the interim opposition leader, David Brazel. We've been talking about some of the... There's nothing going on these days, is there? Nothing to talk about? We're talking about some of the things that are happening in Newfoundland and Labrador today. And yesterday, David, of course, the NDP's effort to get a recount in Signal Hill Kittyvitty was struck down. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's reflective of the fact that the Elections Act is outdated and needs to be, you know, modernized as part of the process. You know, I understand the legal ramifications here, and the law can only work within the parameters of what's written in legislation and follow that. So I understand the ruling itself was based on, the act itself and what the judge could take into account. That's why it's important that the Elections Act be modified and modernized, and that's why, you know, our party and the NDP and the independents had gone to the minister on the premise that they were setting up an all-party committee to look at democratic reform. And we had outlined what we thought would be some terms of reference that would be important to really identify what changes were necessary. Particularly, we all know what we learned from this election. We know it was an extremely challenging one. It was very unique. We wanted to look at exactly what went on in this election so we could better write legislation that would reflect challenges that people face, and to be proactive so that we could identify things that potentially could happen down the road, that we wouldn't run into these issues. There would be very minimal times to challenge stuff because everything would be open and transparent and upfront for individuals. So we're still hopeful that the minister will support what we want to do, and we'll be able to get a piece of legislation that really works for the people here. You know, it's the democratic process, but make sure the democratic process doesn't hinder people from actually exercising that right.
So what were some of those recommendations brought forward?
Well, we had talked about a number of things. We wanted two neutral individuals to be part of the committee from outside any level of government or party. We also wanted to do a full scan of what went on in this election and take our findings from that to make it reflect exactly what should be in legislation as part of that. And we wanted equal representation by all members of the House of Assembly so that then it couldn't be skewed by one party or the other. It would actually be reflective of input from all those in the House of Assembly, and also some neutral individuals from outside. We wanted a neutral chair also to make sure that we addressed all the particular issues that people had brought forward, and we wanted a more open consultation process that would give people an opportunity to really share what the concerns they ran into and some of the challenges they had during this election.
How important is that to you, that all of these different political voices are heard?
Well, I mean, we're in a time now, the world has changed. It's about collaboration. It's about, you know, partnering. It's about doing the right thing. And I would hope, and I'm confident that, you know, all 40 members of the House of Assembly want to do what's best for the people of Newfoundland and Labrador. We may not always agree on what that process should be, but you can't agree or disagree on a process if you don't have the proper democratic process in play. The pillar of any election process got to be the checks and balances and the rules and regulations, and that has to be entrenched in law. To do that, it has to be legislation. To get proper legislation, you must have the proper process to have proper engagement. And we're afraid if we don't do this right now, we'll get one kick at it, that we're upgrading something after 25 years. Let's get it right the first time. Bring in the people who have the ability to also keep things fluent and equal, and more importantly, engaging for everybody out there so we get it right the first time. And this will be our template then forever and a day about how legislation should be done.
Do you find the public tolerance, I suppose, for political games has worn thin? I mean, is there a real attempt now to shift away from those self-interests and political games that are often played in these kinds of things and coming up with solutions that are in the best interest of the public rather than a political hit, if you know what I mean?
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, you know, social media has given the average person access to what goes on in the political reign itself and what goes on in the House of Assembly. People are more aware of those type of things. And the average citizen, or I would think all citizens, want the best thing to be done at the end of the day. Politics is politics. You play politics to get elected. But when you get in there, people's expectation is that you do what's right, and you do what's just, and you do what you think is in the best interest of the people, not only who you serve, but who the House of Assembly is responsible to serving. So people want collaboration. Now, they have no problems with, you know, open debate or even, to a certain degree, disagreement. But at the end of the day, we have to find a mechanism where people come to an agreement that will best serve the people of the province. And you can come up with that while you still disagree. So times have changed. The approach to politics has changed. And, you know, I know in our party, you know, we're open to having proper dialogue. But to have that, everybody got to be sharing the information that they have at their disposal. So at the end of the day, you're making decisions based on fact and not fiction. And that's the only way you're going to be able to serve people in a proper manner.
Is there a way to achieve that, though, in a legislative, you know, you got one side and the other side, and they're talking back and forth, and they're asking each other questions and bobbing and weaving on the floor of the House of Assembly. But it's based on an adversarial type of approach. So how do you make it more collaborative? How do you make it, okay, here's our suggestion. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, some people would say the House itself, the activities of the House in debate are theatrics. And that's fair enough, and there's a role for that. But the important piece of work is done in legislation. Legislation becomes our laws and our policies and our practices for the people in Newfoundland and Labrador. To do that more equitably and to do it more efficiently is find better mechanisms. All party committees have worked. We did a pilot at the last sitting where we took a piece of legislation around the Insurance Act and had an all-party committee analyze it, go through it, could bring in experts to make sure that the information that we were discussing was relevant, bring in other individuals who would have a background in a specific piece of this legislation, and then formulate what we think would be the best piece of legislation. So when it came to the House, it was very unlikely it was going to be negatively debated or that it was going to be in some way amendments made to it, because all parties, because they brought in experts, got to ask all the questions in a timely fashion, not in the House of Assembly when you only got 45 seconds to ask a question and a minister got 45 seconds to respond to it, and then you move on to some other topic. This was done in an all-party committee where the piece of legislation was agreed to, brought to the House, and then passed in the House. That reflected what was the real needs of the people of Newfoundland and Labrador. So we can be doing more of that. We can still have our bantering back and forth as part of the political process, but at the end of the day, we need to find a better mechanism to ensure that the policies and procedures and the legislation that people must follow in Newfoundland and Labrador reflect the information we have and the particular needs that they have out there, and that we don't have to modify it every 2 or 3 years, because we've looked at long-term planning and we started to look at the benefits down the road for everybody.
And I think it would surprise a lot of people, aside from the theatrics, as you put it, of the House of Assembly in question period, but I think it would surprise a lot of people that there is a lot more collaborative type goings on behind the scenes than what many people might perceive.
Oh, exactly. And I mean, the 2019 election, you know, put us in a place with a minority government where it was the first time we were really dealing with that in the House of Assembly. And to do that, it made nobody really wanted to go to an election any immediate period of time. No one party wanted to bring down government, and government didn't want to fall at the time. So there was an opportunity for more collaboration. It probably wasn't as much as I would have liked, but I think we set the template for being able to do it. While I realize there's a majority government there now, the template should be set, and the bar is set that we need to be a little bit more collaborative, because at the end of the day, we all have a stake in this province. You know, I want my life to be comfortable as I do every citizen around me. I want my kids' life to be more comfortable than even mine was, and I would hope my grandkids' lives will be even more comfortable. We want this province to, you know, continue forever and a day. Everybody in this province has a legacy, and their legacy is we've done our small part to make it a better place. Well, you know what? We can start by collaborating. Now, if government brings in something that we disagree with, it's also, as opposition, our role to oppose, not for the sake of opposing, but opposing because the will of the people is not being met, and that the government must understand people need to have input to direct exactly what's in the best interest of them.
Do you have any concerns about the legitimacy of the last provincial election based on the Election Act?
Well, I have a major concerns around the fact that some people's democratic right never got adhered to. People legitimately who wanted to vote did everything that they conceivably possible do to be able to get a ballot to vote, and it still didn't work out for them. So that makes me question, at the end of the day, we need to clean up the Elections Act. We need to be proactive and being prepared for any scenario that may be faced. The fact that, you know, less than 50% of the population voted in the last election is alarming. The fact that maybe 20 or 30% would have no interest in voting anyway for whatever reason, and that's fine. But when there's another 20 or 25% who wanted to vote but couldn't get the mechanism to work for them to get the vote, that becomes a challenge in this past election. We can learn from this. We need to ensure it never happens again. And I think we need to really do it right by engaging people and having the right mechanism, not one particular party making decisions that are arbitrarily in the best interest of them particularly or of another sector in society. It's got to be something that reflects the needs of all Newfoundlanders and Labradorians to be able to exercise their democratic right when it comes to an election.
My guest today on Target is the interim leader of the official opposition, David Brazel. We'll be back right after this.
This is On Target on VOCM. Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back, and you just heard that piece on the U-boat sinking. Our guest today is the MHA for Conception Bay East Belle Island and the interim leader of the official opposition, David Brazel. And David, of course, the big news last week was the long-awaited Green Report. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a rude awakening of our financial situation, and, you know, we're still dissecting exactly, you know, what's included in there, the research that's been used. I mean, 78 recommendations. You know, a number of them we're looking at to see what impact they would have on people's lives. You know, some seem extremely dramatic and would have a major negative impact on people's lives. But we all do accept we all have to take a stake in what's going to happen in Newfoundland and Labrador, and we all may have to make some sacrifices. You know, our hope would be that the sacrifices would be minimal on a particular group or individual, and that it would be spread apart over a period of time so that it has a minimal impact but yet achieves our goal. You know, it's been said, and Moya Green says it here, you know, this didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to be solved overnight. So we need to seriously look at what needs to be implemented. We know we're not hiding behind our, you know, the fiscal challenges we have, but we need to do this tempered, and we need to do it level so that at the end of the day, when we implement something, a change in policy or a change in approach or a financial costing, we need to make sure it doesn't have a negative effect on people if it's around health care, if it's around education, if it's around stability, if it's around out-migration. So there's a number of things here that need to be seriously looked at. We're doing a very in-depth review of it, and we'll be, you know, ready in the near future to be able to talk about, you know, which recommendations we think should be the immediate ones that we move forward, which ones we think should have more engagement with the general public, and people need to be open around these discussions, and information needs to be shared with them. You know, this has to be about, and Lawyer Green says it, accountability and transparency to make these decisions work. So to do that, you got to make sure your government, you shared information with the people. And I mean the accurate information so people understand where they are and that it's not a doom and gloom situation. Is it a challenge? Yes. Is it a major challenge? Without a doubt. But it's not a doom and gloom. So we need to be realistic here, work with people to make solutions work. We've got our unions here who have a wealth of knowledge, provide great services here. What role can they play in identifying efficiencies and ways that we can cut our spending or get better outcomes? And I think we need to have an engaging process that gives every Newfoundlander and Labradorian, and particularly those who represent mass groups, an opportunity to have input and make suggestions on how we can reach our goal. Let's get to a point where, what is it our goal is? Is it we save $1 billion a year? Is it we get better outcomes on the money we spend? Is it we grow the economy? Is it we grow our population? It needs to be clear on what we're doing here. A lot of it is general context, which at times worries me because the old cliche, the devil's in the detail. We'd like to know what that is so then we can analyze exactly how we feel it can be moved forward, or if we think this is even a good recommendation, or maybe the recommendation doesn't go far enough. So, there's a lot of things there that need to be dissected. A couple of things that are missing that's a bit alarming for me is that there isn't a lot of emphasis on, or enough emphasis, in my opinion, on growing the economy. We have so many assets here and so many potential industries that could move forward that we should be re-evaluating how we move those forward and how we partner with the private sector and other jurisdictions to make things happen in Newfoundland and Labrador. The other thing is, we've heard it a number of times from the Premier. He talks about our place in Confederation, and I couldn't agree with him more, that we need to be proud of who we are and what we've contributed. But based on that, there's no conversation here about Ottawa giving us a fair share. I mean, we talk about equalization for years and years. Other provinces, our neighbors, every one of our Atlantic neighbors, and places like Quebec are getting $13 billion a year, and they have a balanced budget, and they cut taxes. And in the last decade, we haven't gotten 5 cents in any transfer payments to Newfoundland and Labrador. Yes, we all know our industry, particularly our biggest revenue-generating industry, the oil industry, has been down. So if we're going to be an equal partner in this confederation, we should be treated equally. So there's no talks there about getting our fair share of equalization as part of this confederation. So there's a few things there that need to be flushed out and I think need to be brought to the forefront when we have discussions with the general public.
Does government have a spending problem?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt, and spending is based on the principle of trying to provide services that people need. We need to get to a point now where we give the services people need versus the services they want. We'd all want to have, the most elaborate services we could get, but Newfoundlanders and Labradorians are realistic that as long as they can get proper services in an equitable fashion, in a timely manner that addresses their needs, they're more than open to be flexible and to give up certain things to ensure that there's still some longevity when it comes to providing services and being able to support our way of life. The issue here becomes about you can't ram certain things down people's throats when you haven't analyzed the impact it may have on another side of that that individual or that sector that might be more detrimental than what you're trying to achieve. So we've got to look at it. If your objective is to save money, well, then you better ensure what you're doing actually saves you money not only up front, but doesn't have a ripple effect that it costs you more on the side. So there's a combination of analyzing it, getting the players at the table who have the ability to do it, and being up front. Tell Newfoundlanders and Labradorians, here's our objective. We need to save X number of dollars. We need to have better outcomes if it's in our construction industry, if it's our healthcare industry, if it's our education. How do we achieve those type of things? And you will find Newfoundlanders and Labradorians, be it individuals or be organizations that represent them, are very creative and very flexible and very cooperative in coming up with solutions to solving our issues here.
Do you think the MHAs are open to making changes themselves? I mean, double dipping was mentioned in the Green Report, and we all know that in some cases, not even double dipping, it's triple dipping and more sometimes. People who are already collecting public sector pensions, getting a second public sector pension, and on it goes. A wage freeze for MHAs, perhaps. Do we need 40 members? Are those some things that MHAs are willing to look at?
MHAs have been open to having discussion on a number of things. You know, one of the things mentioned, there was a wage freeze for MHAs. There hasn't been an increase for MHAs in 13 years. Matter of fact, there's been a number of rollbacks for elected officials. So MHAs are more than willing to do that, as they would expect all Newfoundlanders and Labradorians. You know, you've got to lead by example. So I would suspect that they're much more open to do those type of things. People who have a pension, you know, they've worked for that pension. Whatever career that they've done, they've worked for that. That's their money that they've earned. If you take on a second job, there has to be some sense of remuneration. Can it be collectively looked at so that it isn't a financial burden to the taxpayers? Fair enough. We've had those discussions. You know, I've sat on the management committee for the House of Assembly, and we've made decisions that actually cut services and financial remunerations to MHA. So the will is there 100% to do it. You talked about 40 members. I mean, you know, I was around here when there was 52 members at one point. We knocked it down back in 2015 by 8 members. I don't know if you could go any lower and really represent the people of Newfoundland and Labrador when it comes to that. Can we do things more efficiently? Of course we can. I think there's use of technology. We need to find it, developing better partnerships with different sectors, the private sector, our unions, the general public here to do things that are more efficient. But I must go back and reiterate, if we're to solve these issues, the people of Newfoundland and Labrador need to have a direct input on their suggestions. And I know, you know, people feel that sometimes there's a mentality that if people agree with change as long as it doesn't affect them. I think Newfoundlanders and Labradorians are a little bit more open now to being flexible on everything, as long as it doesn't directly, or I shouldn't say directly, be detrimental to the outcome that we're trying to achieve. If we're going to save $10 and the cost is $100, that's not economy of scale. That doesn't really benefit anybody in Newfoundland and Labrador. I'll give one quick example. When I was in cabinet with then Premier Tom Marshall, and the unfunded pension liability was a big issue. You know, it was a big weight around the necks of the public service and our debt load and all that. The best way to solve it, and he came into cabinet and said, we're going to do this collectively. He called in every one of the unions that would be the recipients of these pension plans and sat down, and over a period of time, and there was a set goal of X number of billion dollars that had to be saved through efficiencies, through changes in the policy, through outcomes at the end of it, and these type of things, collectively between it. And I remember 3 o'clock, 3 a.m. calls and bureaucrats going back and forth. We collectively got to a point where the pension plan, there was a plan over 30 years that it would be now sustainable. And since then, because of the investments, my understanding is it's even closer than the long-term plan. And one day would actually be profitable, that there would be a decision, a three-party decision. The government, the unions, and a third-party entity would decide, we're now making money on this pension plan. Do we give it to government to pay down on a debt? Do we give indexing to pension members, or do we use it for some other programs and services within government? So there's a way of doing that, and the reason I share this is because there's a solution out there if you engage the right people, and most people, I would dictate, are open to being flexible on doing their part to help the people of this province.
When you talk about the number of MHAs, for a long time now there's been discussion about whether or not we need so many members representing urban areas of Newfoundland and Labrador, St. John's, Mount Pearl, you know, the immediate environs, because for most of those citizens, they're represented by their town councils or their city councils, and they have ward councillors and all the rest of it. How busy, I suppose, are some of those urban MHAs, and do we need as many of them?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's always a debate around that. The issue becomes around what may be seen in rural Newfoundland is probably not seen in urban Newfoundland, but what's seen in urban Newfoundland is not seen in rural Newfoundland. So it's hard to put a finger on exactly who is busier, depending on the situation of the day. Now, if you looked at issues happening right now between ferry services, if you're a rural MHA representing a area that has a ferry service, right now you're having a challenging time no matter what happens in this province. If there's something that happens within an urban center, then obviously that becomes a challenge. do I feel that there's a difference there? Sure there is, but there's a lot of commonality. I mean, workers' comp, representing somebody for a workers' comp file in rural Newfoundland or urban Newfoundland is one and the same. So the file, the work you have to do on it is, you know, equally as challenging. So it's hard to say it. I know people look at it, your municipality and urban centers take care of a lot of the day-to-day challenges you may have around snow clearing or ditching and these type of things, but there's still a lot of other challenges that obviously urban MHAs would look at. Now, we're only a year or two away from another review. I suspect the panel that will be put in play will look at, is there a necessity? Normally, it's based on population, because you can never anticipate the issues people may have. So you try to put it within a range so that most of the MHAs, depending on the geographics, would have similar population. So that would, in principle, give them similar workloads when it comes to addressing issues and that. But that variates based on issues, demographics, geographics, and one-off situations that you may run into. So no doubt that'll be reviewed in the next couple of years, and there will probably be some decisions if there's a need to change the boundaries and if there's a need to even reduce the number of MHAs in the House of Assembly.
And you just mentioned, you know, it's a pretty contentious issue, the whole idea of a provincial ferry service to service communities that are separated by water from the mainland of Newfoundland or Labrador. Dame Moya Green mentioned it in her report. Of course, she says, you know, she's not saying that the ferry should be eliminated, but does the provincial government need to offer that service? How do you feel about that? How do the people of your district feel about that?
Well, I mean, people are looking for an equitable service that's being provided for an affordable reality. The issue becomes, you know, whether or not it's the management. You know, I have a real problem with some of the management of some of the ferry services. Unfortunately, part of it is because of out of sight, out of mind. Depending on where you're located, you may not get the attention that's necessary, and then you're doing, piecemeal to try to make a service run. Sometimes decisions are made not in conjunction with the areas that are affected by it. I'm a real believer, and I was, you know, a former minister and started the process to put it in play, that some of these services, the larger ones particularly, should have on-site managers, not managers that are positioned at Confederation Building or in another community away from these sites, so they can go firsthand and be proactive in ensuring that the services ran properly, so that financially it's not a burden on the taxpayers, that if you're given a budget, that you'd be able to stay within that realistic budget, and you provide the service that's necessary to hopefully drive the economy of those communities. So while it seems like a lot of money, and it is, a lot of it is based around the assets, the ferries themselves, a lot of regulatory processes that are in play now when it comes to Transport Canada, collective agreements, all kinds of other issues that people don't see if you're not connected to them. But I think there's an equitable way to do it, developing better partnerships, a better refit process here, better maintenance, and a better scheduling process that looks at which services have the ability to generate something positive for those communities themselves. So the ferry services shouldn't be just thrown out or dismissed because it's an expense. Look at the value of those communities, what can be used in those communities to generate economic growth, and what role do the ferry services play in that, and let's get more efficient on how we operate these ferries.
My guest today on Target is the interim leader of the official opposition, David Brazel. We'll be back right after this.
This is On Target on VOCM. Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. My guest today is the interim leader of the official opposition, David Brazel. And David, some might say that an indicator of just how cash-strapped the province is that we can see it in our infrastructure. You recently brought attention to some pretty abysmal efforts to address road repairs in your district. So what are the solutions there?
Well, you know, we need to find more efficient ways to improve our infrastructure. We need to develop, you know, better partnerships with the private sector. We need to use technology a little bit better. We need to be tracking, some of the faltering issues with infrastructure as it deteriorates to ensure that what would have been a quick, cheaper fix is not left, and now it becomes a very expensive long-term hindrance that costs the taxpayers much more money than it should. So we need to be proactive than reactive, and that was my indication of why I was so upset over this, that there was things that could have been done, you know, all during the winter, not only in my area, but we know all across Newfoundland and Labrador, to be proactive. We sometimes get complacent and we just get ready to react when somebody cries out. We need to be proactive so that we eliminate some of the issues in advance, and that at the end of the day, they become less costly than they would have had we been doing it the right way.
For too long, it seems to me that pavement has been used as a political tool. I don't think I've been in a vehicle yet and gone over some new pavement, and the driver hasn't uttered the phrase, oh, must be an election coming, you know, because even the populace is recognizing that this has been used in that way. How do we get away from that?
Yeah, I think it becomes more noticeable when people start talking about politics, and that normally happens during an election year. But if you look at it, and I'm a former minister, the same amount of money is spent every year over year by every administration around roadwork. Sometimes there's a little bit more put into, fixing bridges or doing culverts and this type of thing. But it becomes the concept that there's more noticeable during election time. Now, there are some ministers or some administrations that will use it closer to an election year to get some notoriety, and that's unfortunate. But the benefit way to do it, the Liberals talked about a five-year plan, something that we were formulating just before the government change, and I applauded them, thought it was a great idea to do a five-year plan so people would know in advance. The question became around what was the criteria to determine the priority of what roads you were going to do and at what time frames and how much of those roads you were going to do, and we still haven't gotten those answers, so that becomes confusing. I think having a roads plan, having a registry of roads that are not up to par or damages, or even if it's pothole registering, would give the depots, you need to be able to give the frontline workers the knowledge of where the issues are, but you also need to be able to give them the resources to do it. Just before, we government changed, I bought four what they call recycling trailers, so that in winter, rather than just put in this coal patch that lasts a day or so because it's not true pavement, we could put in hot pavement that would last weeks before the next frost or the next rain or the next plow came along and took it up. So being proactive on certain things to be able to do it right. But the issue on the roads plan to make it equitable and not politically oriented, stick to your five-year plan, but have it outlined so the general public, talk about transparency and openness, here are the criteria. So you would know where your road would fit on that five-year plan based on the necessity around safety, traffic flow, location, last time it was paved, drainage, flooding, whatever it may be. There needs to be a set of criteria that people would understand, and you would have a better understanding of why your road is not being done or why it's being done for the second time in 10 years. So there's where the plan makes sense in principle, but the plan has also got to have a set of criteria that people understand, and it's actually beneficial to be able to say, these roads are done, next year these roads, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, so you'll know exactly when your road is going to be upgraded to something that's acceptable, and if it's not being upgraded, what minimal interventions need to be done to keep that road safe.
We've had so many reports come out in the last little while, your head spins just thinking about them, and sometimes it's easy to forget. But the Auditor General mentioned that, and it surprised many people to hear that there'd been no monitoring of how the roads are done and whether or not they're holding up and that sort of thing. Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did, because, the five-year plan, again, and I'll reiterate that we applauded what they were putting in play, but to really be able to do that properly, you must have monitoring to know which roads are deteriorating. So if it's on the plan to be done in 5 years, but it's deteriorating twice as fast as you thought, maybe that becomes a priority to move up to year two. So when you're doing it in year two before it's totally deteriorated, it's much more efficient to do and financially beneficial to do at that point and save you money. Not monitoring, not having a tracking system, not having a prioritized system so that the depots themselves would know which roads need to be prioritized. And every year they're going back fixing the same thing day after day, year after year, doesn't make sense. If you know it's going to be a continuous 1 year in a year, well, then you do a permanent fix that construction season so that you don't worry about that. You move on to some other area and you're ensured that part of the road is safe. So it was disturbing because, they're into the fourth year. The Auditor General gave them a set of recommendations that it's only about putting a tracking system in play. It wasn't about let's find the money to invest to build 10 more bridges or to do something else that was necessary. It was a tracking system where people could be engaged. The general public now, you could have 50 to 100,000 employees who you don't have to pay, giving you an update on issues that you may have with your road network, and that wasn't being done, and that to me has been a detriment, and I think it's cost the government money, and I know for a fact, is caused a lot of havoc for people who've lost their tires and their rims because of potholes that weren't identified or dealt with.
How's that pothole now, by the way?
You know, you'll have trouble to find a pothole in my district right now, and I say tongue-in-cheek, but it's not fair, because it shouldn't be who screamed the most or who got the most media attention. There should be a tracking system in play that we would know constant recurring potholes need to be the first priority to address when you get your paving season, so it doesn't exist the next time, and you have a system to know which ones are the most dangerous that you can deal during the winter season to make sure that people are aware they're there, or they're at least filled enough that it's not going to be a danger to the traveling public.
The Green Report came out hot on the heels of the post-secondary education review, and both of them say that, you know, something's got to give, so to speak, with CNA and Memorial University and the amount of money that is provided to those universities. Because let's be clear, it's not government that imposes a tuition freeze. It's the universities, but it's based on the money that they're given by government, if you know what I'm saying. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, there has to be a balanced approach here at the end of the day. I mean, our tuition is at a price now where it's affordable for everybody to come in. I mean, there's all kinds of processes. I had a consultation last night with a group of citizens and business people in my district wanted to meet, and we went through the Green Report nearly 4 hours, and they did talk about post-secondary education. And there's a difference of opinion here on keeping the tuition to a certain reasonable amount so that we do draw as many students as possible and make it affordable. There was issues around means testing, that if you're moving in from a rural area into an urban area, you have other expenses other than just tuition that would have a detriment on your financial process. You know, any institution needs to have core funding to be sustainable and to move forward. You know, I think it needs to be a dialogue here with the student unions, with faculty, with the general public. The taxpayers have an input here. I think there's a system here, and what I heard last night alone, and some of these were educators from the college systems and this, some other people have been former senior bureaucrats, and some are business people and from outside, that there has to be an approach here looking at a means testing that would identify any changes that we make would not be so detrimental that people either choose not to do a certain thing, and that would be detrimental to our education system or our health care or anything else that may be, you know, pertinent to people's lives in this province. So, again, inclusion here is very important. Openness and transparency is very important. I now get why the Green Report didn't come out during the election, because, you know, it would have been total upheaval and the whole discussion would have been a different target. But right now we need to do the right things, and the right thing is have people engaged, bring in those who have the expertise, and ask Newfoundlanders and Labradorians to work with the people in the House of Assembly to find solutions to get us on stable ground and have a brighter future.
David Brassel, I really appreciate your time this afternoon. I would normally say let's see what the weeks and months ahead bring, but let's wait and see what today brings. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Alrighty. And we'll be back tomorrow. We're going to be talking heart and stroke tomorrow, because that's a very important issue. Stay tuned for that, and thanks for listening.